Afternoon. This is the Senate Finance Committee. Today is Monday, April 14th, 2014. It's 1:34 in the afternoon. With me this morning, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, myself, Senator Fairclough. Welcome. On today's agenda, we have HB 75, contributions from the PFD, audits from the university, and HB 278, education funding tax credits and programs. First before the committee will be HB 75. Is there any comments from the members before we begin? Joining us at the table is Representative Paul Seaton's staff, Heather Beggs. Heather, would you introduce the bill for us?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Heather Beggs, staff to Representative Seaton, and he sends his apologies. He's got a bill up in another committee. House Bill 75 allows greater participation in the Pick-Click-Give program by small nonprofits that meet all of the eligibility requirements for the program but do not participate due to the cost-prohibitive audit requirement. And we're really happy to report the success of Pick-Click-Give over the last 6 years. Over $10 million have been donated to organizations for the first 6 years of the program. And in 2014, we broke records with $2.7 million donated by over 40,000 Alaskans to 512 nonprofits. The current statute requires organizations with a total annual budget that exceeds $250,000 to have a full financial audit by a CPA. House Bill 75 will only require those organizations that file a federal audit to submit a copy to the state. These are organizations that expend $500,000 or more in federal grant awards. Constituents statewide with budgets over $250,000 have reported to us that they would need to spend $7,000 to $15,000 on an audit by a CPA each year that they want to apply for Pick-Click-Give, and this creates a bar to small organizations being listed. Donations from Pick-Click-Give may only total a few hundred dollars, and organizations need to be responsible in the way they spend donor funds on providing services and also other appropriate levels of financial review. CPAs also agree that a full audit is not the best option for small organizations, and you can see over a dozen letters in your packet from organizations that have brought this problem to us, among them the Literacy Council of Fairbanks, the Fairbanks Art Association, and the original organizations that brought it to our attention, the Ketchikan Area Arts Council and the Seward Senior Center. There is certainly a lot of accountability required for applicants to the Pick-Click-Give program. Organizations already must file a Form 990 with the IRS to be eligible to participate. This now is a 12-page form that requires strict financial accountability and has been overhauled a great deal since the original legislation created the program. And also the 990 is available online to anyone, whereas a CPA audit is not. There's also been community confusion among these organizations who have contacted us. Not being listed on the Pick-Click-Give list has adversely affected organizations when donors assume that their charity no longer meets eligibility requirements for tax-deductible contributions, which certainly isn't the case. The Pick-Click-Give program is just a vehicle for Alaskans to give to their favorite charities. This bill will also treat the University of Alaska campuses like other applicants, requiring them to pay the $250 application fee. The House Finance CS requires only the three main campuses to be listed, and all the other campuses may be listed. Each campus must pay the $250 fee, and the university has testified that they support this change. Separate from the application fee, which is used for the division's administration of the program, this bill adds a 7% coordination fee, which is used for statewide marketing and outreach, and that would be withheld from the contributions, withheld from the annual payment to an organization, and it's based on the contributions received through Pick-Click-Give, and that would start in 2015. The Rasmussen Foundation has, their initial promise was to fund this statewide outreach and marketing, which is kind of the success of Pick-Click-Give that you see on your TV screens and online every day through the season. But they had promised to fund it for the first 3 years of the program, but now it's been 6 years, so we do need a plan for sustainability of the program. And the 4-Acre Group actually surveyed nonprofits that are participating in the program, and there was strong support from nonprofits that are engaged that they want to see this statewide marketing and outreach continue. And they also looked at options presented by the 4-Acre Group and decided that a percentage fee, which we're proposing in this bill, was the best solution to keeping the program sustainable. So this legislation would first be applied to contributions starting in 2015. And finally, there is a Senate CS that was drafted that would correct the non-conforming sections of statute, which was belatedly found by the drafter, who's also here online to testify if needed. But there, in subsection A and E of 43.23.062, those sections would actually prevent the department from implementing a 7% coordination fee, so we do want to clean up that language, and that was version Y. So House Bill 75 solves a number of oversights in the original legislation. The university doesn't object to paying their application fee like everyone else, and we're making a plan for long-term sustainability of a popular program benefiting organizations across the state. And now the program can be accessed by all organizations should you like to pass House Bill 75.
Thank you for that introduction. First, I'd just like to let the committee know that there was a drafting error and the language has been sent, but we just don't have it in front of us yet, so there will be a CS coming to committee members on this particular bill. But the committee members do not have that in their packets at this time. Are there questions on the introduction? Seeing and hearing none, if we could have the Department of Revenue come forward. Is it DeBartlow?
DeBartolo.
DeBartolo. Sir, your name for the record, and if you could give us comments on the bill before the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dan DeBartolo. I'm the director for the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. And the bill in front of you, first and foremost, I'll tell you, does not change anything fiscally for our division as far as operations are concerned. We support the bill in its current draft. And from our standpoint, the current amendments, specifically the 7%, is what I'd like to speak to. How that would function for us is once pledges are made, as they were just during this past filing season, during the period up to the point where we pay that actual dividend to everybody, we will compile that information, and at the point of distribution, that 7% will be taken right from that distribution amount in October through December as we make those payments. That money will be kept in a separate account and reported to the legislature as we are required to every January when we make the reports about how much has been contributed from the program. That will be then the opportunity for the legislature to appropriate those funds into the next year's budget. And the division itself currently operates the Pay Click Give program on the $250 fees, as Heather was mentioning, and we would not be using any of this money for actually operating the program, which we currently contract with United Way, where they vet the actual applications that come in from the organizations interested in being part of the Pay Click Give program. And they vet that list, they give it to us, and we make sure that's up and running on January 1st of every year. We also have some internal programming, of course, associated with that. Those come from the $250 fees that would not come from the 7%, which will be just towards outreach, advertising, things that I know Rasmussen has indicated they have been spending annually at least over $250,000 a year on.
Are there questions from committee members? Seeing none, thank you so much for that presentation. Mr. Chris Christensen with the university, would you like to approach the committee? And if you have any comments that we should hear from the university's perspective, this particular version has affects the university.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Chris Christensen, University of Alaska. Madam Chair, we're participating in the program. We're benefiting from it, and we certainly have no objection to paying application fees like private charities. I just would note that when the program first started, the first year we raised about $6,000. The next year, about $16,000. 2 years ago, $25,000, and last year, $28,000. So we've got a steady uptick. And the last 2 years, ExxonMobil has generously agreed to match anything we raise. So we're actually raising closer to $60,000 a year through this program.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing none, I have a question. As a former executive director of a nonprofit and for the last 7 years working at Hospice of Anchorage, one of the issues that the nonprofit community has discussed with the university is that you're listing all of your different campuses, and so there's a, when a nonprofit only can list one, like Hospice of Anchorage or the Aware Shelter or Awake or anywhere across our state, they don't list programs, and you're listing individual campuses, and so you have a higher rate of being visually able to see the university for giving purposes. And so how should the committee consider that as we look at your multiple lines and asking for more than one time from the people under Pick, Click, and Give?
Madam Chair, I would not expect all the campuses to be listed. What we've discovered is that about a half a dozen campuses, for example, don't even raise as much money as this application fee would be. One issue we deal with is that most people who give to the university don't want to give a check to the university. They want to focus the money on a specific campus or a specific program. That's where most of our money comes in. There have been proposals that university programs be allowed to be listed, not just campuses, and I'm sure there are many programs that would get contributions, like the University of the North. The problem, of course, is you could swamp this list with hundreds of university programs, so that's not something we have suggested or proposed. I believe there are now hundreds and hundreds of private charities on the list, and I would expect to see a dozen or so university things listed, so I don't think it will cause that much of a problem.
Any additional questions? Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Candace Winkler, are you online? I have her as a possible invited testimony. Jordan Marshall? Hillary Martin?
Yeah, this is Hillary Martin with Legislative Legal Services. I'm just on the line to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you very much. Okay, that's all our invited testimony. With that, I'd like to open the public hearing on the CS or House Bill 75 finance. That is an act amending certain auditing requirements for entities receiving contributions from the permanent fund dividends. Is there anyone wishing to testify here in Juneau? Anyone online wishing to testify on HB 75? Going once? Going twice? Closed. The public hearing is closed. With that, if the committee would look at the fiscal notes, I would direct your attention to fiscal note. I'm looking for fiscal note number one because I only have two and three. I'll direct your attention to fiscal note number two. It's an indeterminate. And fiscal note number three, beginning in FY 2016, $4,300 going out to FY 20 on this fiscal note. Is there any questions from committee members on the fiscal notes? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing was open and closed. We'll set this bill aside. The next item before the committee is HB 278, Education Funding, Tax Credits, and Programs. We have invited testimony from the Department of Education. Is there someone here from the Department of Education? Brief at ease. Senate Finance Committee is back in order. Before the committee is HB 278. Senator Bishop, I'm so sorry. Welcome. You've been here for some time and participated in the entire discussion on the last committee, as well as Senator Meyer may be taking the gavel here in just a few minutes. I know he's running in and out of meetings. Do I have the commissioner here? Welcome.
Thank you.
Your name for the record, please.
For the record, my name is Mike Henley. I'm the commissioner for the Department of Education and Early Development.
Thank you, Commissioner. We are endeavoring to get to the public hearing, but I believe that happens tomorrow. It already happened. Thank you. Does the committee have additional questions for the commissioner? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. You may not be the most knowledgeable on bandwidth and those kind of things, but I was wondering if you could answer just a few questions, because I really don't have any idea, since I've only, you know, it's kind of after my years in school. I was just wondering, what do you think the minimum amount of bandwidth that each of these schools across the state of Alaska in the 53 school districts, what do you think that should be available to those students? Do you have any idea?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I really don't have a great idea. It's not to to shirk that question by any means. Different districts use different amounts, and honestly speaking, that for a long time we're going to use as much as we can get, because the opportunities out there, the technology that's available, the tools, the educational tools that are available, use increasingly greater amounts of bandwidth for all online applications. So we'll be a long time before we get caught up with the need, but I don't have a good understanding of what that amount is for our schools.
Senator Olson, please.
Continue, Madam Chairman. As you look at bandwidth and the numbers, you know, we may not know what they are, but don't you agree that because of the shrinking revenues that are coming in, as we look at science, technology, engineering, mathematics, that those are kind of the basics for being able to have interactive, and if we were to be able to have distance learning, would you agree that having more bandwidth is advantageous to all involved?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, absolutely. Increased bandwidth is becoming a quality of life issue, not just an educational issue, in the 21st century. And we're expecting our kids to move into and be prepared for jobs that are going to require some level of technology and understanding of how that all works and a proficiency in it. So, absolutely.
Last question, Madam Chairman.
You're awesome.
Has to do with, if you were looking at that and you had a, if you had the money available, how much do you think you'd be willing to go ahead and spend on increasing bandwidth to all the school districts across Alaska? And you can opt not to answer the question as well.
Commissioner.
To the chair, the hypothetical, if I had the money, I guess it wouldn't be a matter of, if I had the money, I would look at how much, you know, I would do the analysis of how much bandwidth we need. And I'd be looking at the 50 to 100 megabits, you know, somewhere in there for all of our communities. Not all of our communities, specifically for all of our schools, from the Commissioner of Education's perspective.
Last comment, Madam Chairman. So if you're dealing with, that's okay.
Senator Olson, we do have, I believe, I'm going to check. Do we have Robin Graham online? Senator Olson, our office has been contacted. We served on your subcommittee, and I believe we do have some additional information, but please continue.
If you talk about 50 to 100 megabytes per second, I'm assuming you'd be delighted if we were to at least get to 10 for all school districts. Is that correct?
Through the chair, any direction we move forward is going to be beneficial for our kids.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
And
thank you,
Chair Faircloth, I do believe that Robbie Graham is ill today. She was prepared to be here. I believe there's somebody else that's going to be online to take her place, but she had an emergency.
Thank you, Commissioner. Is Linda Thibodeau here? Would she like to approach the committee and add any additional comments to Senator Olson's questions? We also have Jim Bates that might be able to offer a perspective.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Linda Thibodeau, and I'm the Director of Libraries, Archives, and Museums. And I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have for me.
Ms. Thibodeau, I think Senator Olson was referring to E-rates, and the committee is trying to see what the department's position is on what our capacity would be to provide digital learning or at least internet access for different school districts throughout our state.
Yeah, Madam Chair, do you want me to ask the question again?
Senator Olson, please.
Sure. Mr. Thibodeau, what do you believe is the minimum amount of bandwidth that a school across the state of Alaska that should be available to students?
Through the chair to Senator Olson, I don't really have an answer to that. It depends on the need of the school, of course, and the kinds of information that's trying to be transmitted across the internet. But I believe for high quality interconnectivity that 10 megabits is probably very low. So beyond that, I think would probably be all the more the better. We found with bandwidth needs, the more you have, the more they need it. It's just kind of a continuing and growing circle of use.
And my other question, Madam Chair.
Please, Senator Olson.
Had to do with what's the amount of, if that's the case, that if you think 10 megabytes is a little on the low side, what is the amount of bandwidth that would be required to deliver high-quality interactive courses to middle and high school students related to science, essentially STEM, the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics?
I would have to concur through the chair to Senator Olson, with what the commissioner said. 50 to 100 sounds wonderful. Not being a bandwidth expert, actually, our business is more in helping the schools get the connectivity that they can afford and that they need. That's my best answer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I know Senator Dunleavy might be right to you. I've asked my staff if she could speak to it. I believe we're in contact. Aaron, could you put yourself on the record? And we have been in contact with the administration, and so just so that the committee knows where we're working right now. Aaron, if you could introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Aaron Shine, and I am staff to Senator Anna Fairclough. I have been in contact with Robbie Graham, who is the, I believe, the assistant director of DCED, and from my understanding with her, she and Bob Wicker, who's I think in the audience, have been working with the task force on broadband, the governor's broadband task force, and there is potentially some funds left over from that can be reappropriated to do a study specifically to school districts and what their interconnected what they have or what they do not have, and that could potentially start and end by this fall and have that report back to the legislature and to other entities that are interested in what the needs are for each school district.
Ms. Shine, and just to highlight that, then our understanding is that there was a survey done versus a study, and I think I've spoken to that before in front of this committee, and the administration is willing to open up the contract right now and actually do an audit so that we understand specifically what the hardware capacity is out there and then look at trying to prioritize our investments so that we can bring those communities online. Is that a fair description of our communication so far, Ms. Shine?
From my understanding, that's correct. I believe that Robbie Graham might have more information specifically as to what they'll be focusing on, specifically to the RFP and the scope of work that they'll be using for collecting that information.
Thank you, Ms. Shine. Senator Olson, did you have something else?
Actually, the comment that I have to do is that as you look at the issue that's coming forward, if we were to go ahead and even approve it for this year, we would be several years out before it would become available, and that's why I think I'm trying to bring it up to bring it to the forefront, because this is the time to act as opposed to next year, which we go on a cycle.
Senator Olson, the bill that you have in this committee certainly provides an opportunity for Alaska to receive some matching money, so I certainly would support you in your effort to add that. I do have a little bit of trouble with the escalator that was built in on that particular bill, but addressing the E-rate and broadband with, I think, is a good thing for an education bill coming forward. Commissioner, I wanted this on the record because I hope that you'll support our request to open up that study and actually do or open up the survey and money and actually do a study so that we understand what smaller communities actually have in the form of hardware. Our office has also been in touch or will be in touch with NCSL as well as CSG, looking at what we should ask for in a broadband study versus a survey. So we're trying to be helpful and not hinder a process, but try to broaden the request appropriately. Thank you, Ms. Schein. Any other questions for Commissioner? Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Hanley, I may have asked this if I have, forgive me, but has the department taken a position on tenure, their thoughts on tenure? And if so, can you reiterate what those are?
Through the Chair, Senator Dunleavy, no, the department has not taken a specific stand on the tenure issue.
Senator Dunleavy, follow up.
Well, it's actually a different topic.
Senator Meyer, did you have a follow up on the tenure? Okay. Senator Dunleavy, please continue.
Through the Chair, thank you. The rating system, whether it be stars or numbers, as we discussed earlier, previous meeting, was due to some extent from our waiver through the federal government for NCLB, that we would be rating schools, correct?
We needed a separate accountability system if we were going to get rid of the one that's a partner or child left behind, correct?
Okay, so regardless of how that's going to turn out, whether it's letters or numbers, there'll be a rating system that'll be put into place within the next year or two, correct?
Through the Chair, it's been in place for about a year now.
So there's criteria as to how one is rated, whether they get a 4-star or A, B, C, D, F, whatever, however
Correct.
You want to call it. Okay. And we had a little bit of a conversation if you were in a 1-star school. What is the department going to do for that particular school? And are there mandates from the federal government to move a school from a 1-star to a 2 or 3 or 4-star? Or is it just a rating system and that's where it ends?
Through the Chair, it's not just a rating system, which would just be words on paper, if you will. It's an accountability system, and it informs schools and the state just where we need to provide additional resources in order to recognize great growth and great performance. So we come alongside of, and it's very specific. We have focused and priority schools that are 1- and 2-star schools, and it's more detail than we need to go into here. But on our lowest performing schools, we come alongside. We provide mentors and coaches for those communities. We work alongside of them. We collaborate with them on helping them address some of their concerns and moving forward.
And one last follow-up,
Senator Dunleavy,
on that topic through the Chair. So if they're over time, if there is no movement out of a 1-star or an F school or whatever the symbol being used, if there's no movement, what happens? In other words, if I'm a 1-star school and I don't move for 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, does it matter? I guess what I'm trying to ask is, if the school doesn't move, is it something we should be worried about and concerned about? In other words, is there going to be money or funds put towards that endeavor, or is it something where it just, and I don't want to say it doesn't matter, that's not what I want to, but I'm just trying to understand what the plan is. We can rate the schools, I get that. We can rate them upon criteria, I get that. But I would imagine that there's a purpose in doing that, to move them into a higher quality status for the benefit of kids. That's where I start to try and get my arms around how is that going to happen, because inevitably it's going to involve resources. And if so, what is that plan? I'm just wondering if there's one that's been totally thought out, and including budgets.
Through the Chair, we maximize the resources that we have now and work with those districts and those specific schools, teachers, and principals to the greatest extent possible. With additional funding, we would meet the needs of a lot more schools that are on that lower end of the spectrum. In regards to schools that don't move, I'm very impressed with our mentors and our coaches. A lot of them are retired, high quality, and experienced and trained teachers and administrators to do this work. They bring a level of expertise to the communities that we believe is an asset, and we're getting a lot of positive feedback from those communities as well. What happens if they don't move forward? Well, we don't keep doing the same things, but we also have to recognize that there's a good portion of a star system that is academic, and appropriately so in an education system. You get credit or points on a scale for growth and for the number of students you're getting to be proficient, and for graduation rate. But there are a lot of things we know in our schools that don't have a lot to do with that. We have schools that are struggling with social issues, that are struggling with suicide, that are struggling with alcoholism. We've got schools that are reported to be have students with over 80% of them having FASD. We're going to continue to work alongside of them to help them be absolutely as successful as possible. It may not look like it does in another school, though, but I don't think we need to say, oh, we need to walk away or we need to ship these students out. We need to continue to provide the support, not only for the school, but without a mission creep, providing it for the community and for the families as well to the greatest extent possible.
For the record, that was Commissioner Hanley.
I'm sure on that point.
Senator Olson.
Commissioner, does the state have offer incentives to urge teachers to work on these one-star schools?
Senator Chair, not at this time, we don't.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Dunleavy, will you yield? We have someone else waiting. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for getting the meeting started. I was down in Hess helping pass some bills out of there. And today's forum, from an education standpoint, is just kind of for us to ask you questions. And then also, I've asked David Teal here to help us explain funding and how that works, how that works. And all of us here have been getting a lot of questions on the various education bills. There's the governor's, of course, the House's, and then the Senate education. And just a few questions that have come up to me, and I don't have the answers, and I'm hoping I could ask you. First one has to do with, Madam Chair, is that
please.
Okay? Yeah, first one has to do with charter schools. There's a lot of folks I really support charter schools, and they certainly serve a purpose. But the concern is that a lot of times the money doesn't follow the kids to the charter schools. So if you could address that and how we might be able to fix that. And then also there's some concern that in one of the bills there was a 4% administration cap. But even with the 4% net administration cap, how do we prevent the school districts from doing large chargebacks and getting money back from the charter schools that way, and how can that whole process maybe work a little bit better?
Commissioner Hanley.
Sure. Thank you. Beginning with the funding portion, I know I've stated this before, but current statute says that the budget for a charter school shall not be less than the amount generated by the students in that school, enrolled in that school. And that's basically what it says. It should be determined in the same manner as it is for all other schools in that district. So the idea behind that language is equity. What the governor started this conversation with was saying, we need to specify a couple things here. We need to clarify what that means with a fund generated by a student. It's more than that BSA component that you saw in the chart. It includes the special education component, that 20%. It includes that vocational technical education part. It includes some transportation components. And interestingly, a conversation I've had since then is, well, what about this one-time funding that has gone out? Now, that's not introduced into this bill, but that one-time funding, the $25 million that has gone out for energy. I mean, how does a district get that? It's generated to the district by students. So those funds are generated by those students as well, and they should be getting their portion of that. The idea is not to create super schools here, but to create equity and make sure that the intent of the original statute is met by bringing some clarification there. In regards to the 4%, the idea behind that, obviously, again, is that the districts aren't withholding more than they should. There are examples, I think, that people share of that happening, and I've got other superintendents that say, I'm disappointed to hear these conversations because we treat our charter schools well. They're our schools. They're our shining stars. Of course we treat them well. We provide them the transportation. We don't need a law like this because we're doing it already, and that's very true. But the idea is that a school district provides solidity for a charter school. They make them less vulnerable than standing totally on their own. They're allowed autonomy, but the school district provides a lot of support in regards to the federal mandates and the reporting mandates, the funds that come from the state, the reporting that has to come out from the state. Those types of things. They typically provide other services as well, but not always. I think the question for the legislature, for the Senate, is when a charter school comes into place, they've been accepted by a school district, they have a contract between that APC, that Academic Policy Committee, which is typically parents, and the school district, and say, here's the contract, here's what our budget's going to look like, here are the services we'll provide, maybe we can get help here, we'll buy those back, those types of things. It's how much does the state want to step into the middle of those contracts and say, you have to run your contract like this. I think the potential here is that they can be and should be done well. I think there are examples where some districts are being a little bit stingy. I think this conversation alone has changed conversations in some of those districts, but I think the language that's already in this bill is going to help.
Senator Meyer.
Okay, I'll accept that. May I go to another topic for the commissioner?
Please, for the committee's edification, we have Robbie Graham online now. If we want to return to the E-rate conversation in a little bit. We have Robin Williams from the Tax Division, Jim Bates from he's the Director of Enterprise Technology Services, and Juanita Ayers from the Department of Labor. I think I've got everybody. So just so the committee knows they're following now. Senator Dunleavy, I'll be back to you after.
And Senator Fergal, they would be great ones for the TVEP and the CTE as well as the E-rate broadband conversation.
Senator Meyer.
Okay, great. The next question I have had to do with I'm not sure if this is in any bills or somebody just proposed the idea or maybe it's in another bill. The ANSET program, expanding that to middle schools, I think the potential cost on that is $3 million. Can you explain why that would be so much and do you support something like that?
The ASF component is currently a function of the University of Alaska. We have about just under $1 million that flows through our budget to support that. There's not a separate bill in regards to that. What we're seeing, and I believe you've probably had presentations I think you've had Herb Schroeder come and speak, maybe not this year, does a tremendous job, great results for students, especially Alaska Native students coming from small rural areas, coming in and doing what we know those students can do anyway, but they're rising to the challenge of taking high-level math and science courses and walking out of high school with several credits at the university and oftentimes walking in and taking courses that are at sophomore and junior math levels at the university, coming straight out of high school. Tremendous results coming out of ANSEP, especially in the areas of STEM. With that said, one program, one area that they are looking at doing, they start their program in eighth grade. And they introduce students into what they'll need to be taking and setting a vision for high school when they get there. And that begins with a computer build program. They actually build their own computer. And the deal is if they complete a certain number of math courses, by the time they graduate from high school, they get to keep that computer. It's a great incentive to get kids involved and connected to some higher level thinking and to some higher, more lofty goals. The amendment in regards to ANSEP is to really encourage that eighth grade, that middle school component, to bring students from their communities to a larger community, oftentimes to Anchorage, to the ANSEP, where they get to see what it looks like on a college campus, and really help set that vision so they've got time when they leave and go back to their communities to put things in place to graduate with those goals in mind.
Thank you.
That's all I have. Thank you,
Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Meyer. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, through the Chair. Commissioner, I'm wondering if you can comment on the following. So there's 54 school districts in the state of Alaska, and the legislature is charged with the concept of establishing and maintaining a system of public schools, which is in the Constitution. how, from your perspective, how does, how, what does that relationship look like? One of, quote, local control and one of the school, the state funding, especially in REAs, which is a direct relationship and an unorganized borough concept. But what is the relationship? What can the legislature expect from the school districts, from your perspective? When we talk about local control, for some that means, you know, fund us, which we should, we must, but then kind of ends there. Let us decide what we're going to do at the local level. What can the legislature expect going forward in terms of expectations, outcomes, what do programs look like? I mean, do you believe that the legislature should have the ability to help determine what programs look like, or determine how education is delivered? What are your thoughts on that in relationship to the local control concept?
Commissioner Hanley.
To the Chair, Senator Dunleavy, what we put in place in exchange for state funding is some targets that to make sure that when kids have the opportunity to get an education, that they do have an opportunity to get an education. It's in a healthy and safe environment, and they're progressing towards a time when they graduate from high school, and even before, when they are successful with the tools they need to be successful beyond. That's the ultimate goal. That's why we have assessments in grades 3 through 10 to help get a dipstick and measure those students on how they're doing. That's why we have the accountability system in place that now includes attendance and graduation rate and other things besides those test scores. But there's a lot between the funding over here and the outcomes over here. We have a target here. When they're not on that trajectory to get there, we step in and provide supports for them. But you're exactly right. In the meantime, they get to determine what's the most relevant and contextual and appropriate way to do that in their communities. And that looks very different, obviously, from community to community and from district to district.
Senator Dunleavy. Senator Olson, did you want to go back to speaking about the E-rate broadband?
Actually, Madam Chair, I think Senator Bishop had a question. I was going to go back to that afterwards.
Please, Senator Bishop.
No, my information is coming through.
Okay. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And this is product of Ms. Graham. Are you on, ma'am?
Robin Graham, are you online? Graham?
Yes, I am online. Thank you.
Welcome, Robin. Senator Olson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Ms. Graham, what do you believe is the minimum amount of bandwidth that a school should have available to students throughout the state of Alaska? Do you have any
Senator
idea?
Senator Olson, through the chair, when the Broadband Task Force looked at education as a component of the overall statewide study that we did, we found that the minimum speed that most schools have is about 1.5 megabits per second. Certainly some in the more urban areas have faster speeds, but the federal government has recently issued a notice of proposed rulemaking that is looking to essentially change the E-rate program and require that America schools will have broadband speeds of no less than 100 megabits per second by 2015. So overall, we're seeing a need for greater speed and for increased digital learning, and that's what we're working towards.
Senator Olson, follow up.
Thank you. Continue, Madam Chairman. As we look at, as you talked about some of the federal issues that are coming into play here, if Alaska is supposed to be spending a dollar for funding on E-rate or essentially broadband, what kind of, how much is the federal government going to be funding on top of that? Do you have any idea?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I'm not quite sure because this is the entire E-rate program as part of the universal service reform is going through a proposed rulemaking and it's bound to change. We're unsure as to what it's going to look like, and Commissioner Hanley and I have talked about this in the past. Currently, I think there's somewhere in the neighborhood of $2.3 billion for schools and libraries through the universal service reform, but I'm unsure as to what it's going to look like in the future.
And continue, Madam Chair.
Please.
It's my understanding that for every dollar the state puts into essentially broadband, the federal government puts in $4, so that the $7 million issue that we were talking about, we'd be getting $28 million from the federal government. Is that not true?
Senator Olson, through the chair, that sounds about right to me.
If I can continue, Madam Chairman.
Senator Olson, if we could have Commissioner Hanley follow up after you're finished, please go ahead.
How much, Ms. Graham, how much or what amount of bandwidth would be required to go ahead and deliver high-quality interactive courses for high school and middle school students for essentially the basic STEM courses, the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics? Can you give us an idea?
Senator Olson, through the chair, the ideal speed, of course, would be 100 megabits per second, but that has a dollar amount associated with it that can be difficult. So we're looking at 15, 25, and up to 50 megabits per second would be, at least at this moment, at this point in time, a reasonable amount of speed. But going into the future, as we improve our technology and we improve our delivery, we are looking towards at least 100 megabits per second.
Senator Olson.
My last comment or question, whatever, however you want to phrase it, is that if those schools that are less than 10 megabytes out there have to wait for the results of the survey or analysis, whatever's going on, to increase their bandwidth, I don't see anything to be gained by waiting for those. Do you agree with that?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I listened to the testimony a bit earlier in the comments by Ms. Schein, and we have been in discussion. I just want to put into perspective what we're trying to do and give you a timeline for it. The survey that Connected Nation and Connect Alaska will do on behalf of the Statewide Broadband Task Force will start most likely in May or June. It's our intent to survey most rural schools and as many as we possibly can get to understand better what speeds actually are being delivered and what kind of connectivity there is in each school in order to receive that bandwidth. So our intent is to survey this summer and have initial results this fall, and certainly working with the committee on what the requirements will be to complete the survey and to make sure it's as complete as possible.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I don't have any further questions, just a last comment that from what I'm interpreting from here, that those schools that have less than 10 megabytes per second are going to have to wait until the analysis is done. They're going to be doing a detriment to them because they'd be farther back than they would if they were taken care of to bring them up to 10. With that, thank you very much for the question.
Commissioner Hanley.
And I would like the commissioner's input on that as well.
I think your analysis is correct. That if we've determined that we recognize that anything below 10 is low. So the timeliness of getting districts up to 10, schools up to 10 and higher, it's a function of when we decide to do it and what factors will get us there. If I may, there's one question, and I may like to ask Robbie as well, for my own understanding as well as for this committee's understanding in regards to the 4-to-1 rate. My understanding is the generation of those funds was not necessarily generated specifically by how much Alaska was willing to put in, and then the federal government then in turn put in 4-to-1. So Robbie, if I could simply ask the question for clarity, with the current system that we have in place, with no changes to the federal program, if Alaska puts in additional funds, will it generate at the same rate, that 4-to-1, from federal E-rate funds?
Commissioner Hanley, through the chair, I don't know the answer to your question, and I apologize for not having the statistics right at hand, but I do know that, as you know, the faster the speed, the more speed that's delivered, the more it costs. And so we all assume that, at least from the task force perspective, that as speeds increase and as capability comes online, whether it's through additional backbone or through additional fiber, it will become more expensive. And so whether it's 4-to-1 or otherwise, I don't know.
Thank you for the leniency in allowing me to ask that question.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. Thank you, Commissioner.
I have a question to the Commissioner.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, Madam Chair, if the federal requirements or the federal goal is to get 100 megabytes by 2015, and the state of Alaska, because of its high cost to get to that level, it seems as though we in the state are going to be lagging behind. But it seems to me that the longer we take to get the whole state of Alaska up to the 100 megabytes per second, the farther those students that fall in the category of between 10 and 50 are going to be falling behind. So would you agree with that statement?
Commissioner Hanley.
Senator Hoffman, I don't know if there's a one-to-one correlation between E-rate or the amount of megabits that are into a school and a student actually falling behind. It would create greater challenges, no doubt. They would have to use different tools as they are now, but would they automatically fall behind? What we're finding now is that schools use different methodologies. Instead of everyone getting online at the same time, they may use a local caching system.
Then look at it the other way. If they don't get the 100 megabytes and they're stuck at 10 for, say, 5 years, you think they'd spring ahead and jump to the head of the class?
Mr. Hanley.
I think the challenge of that is even greater. So I do recognize the challenge. I just don't know that it's going to necessitate or necessarily mean that our students will suddenly fall farther behind. But the opportunity or the potential for that is greater than if we were at equal bandwidth.
Commissioner Hanley, I think I don't want to speak for anyone else. So I'll just speak for myself. Commissioner Hanley, if this committee were to include in the education bill that comes out of this committee an appropriation for E-rate, could you use it to prioritize communities, students that are affected by lack of internet speed, that money?
Absolutely. And with language that I have seen in the past, it would be determined, we would have our parameters set, and if it were to come through us at all, it may come through Commerce, but in any case, it would be an improvement to our schools.
Thank you. And then, Commissioner, I just would like to put on the record again that when we're using the word survey, I'm troubled. We're trying to research right now with CSG and others that have looked at broadband with what questions a layman like me, when it comes to internet or IT technology in general, what questions I should ask in those communities so that we can try to get the delivery that may be mandated. The other question that I have, Senator Hoffman referred to by 2015, I captured the 100, is it mega?
Bits.
Megabits per second. Is it indeed the federal government shooting for implementation of 2015 for that 100? Ms. Graham, do you know that?
Chair Faircloth, yes. From the FCC, we know that, and in the notice of proposed rulemaking, that the federal government is targeting 99% of America's schools to have broadband speeds of no less than 100 megabits per second by 2015, with the ultimate goal or the ultimate target of 1 gigabit per second by 2020. So it is coming from the FCC, and with the proposed rulemaking, we will be sure to see some outcome of that recommendation.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. I appreciate you calling in. I know that there are some issues related to you being here today, and so we truly appreciate you going above and beyond. I would just ask one additional thing. I would like to inform committee members that amendments are due to the bill before us by 5:00 today. And so I'm wondering, Ms. Graham, if there's a possibility that you could send us that requirement so that we could include intent language for the department to begin implementation of the higher transmission level so that we can include that in the governor's bill. Is that
Senator
possible?
Senator, I'd be happy to.
Thank you. And so what I'm looking for is that federal requirement, the FCC and their rulemaking proposal is looking at American schools having no less than the 100 megabits per second by 2015. So we can add that into intent language if this committee chooses to advance that thought.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
And I believe she stated by 2020, 1 terabit as the minimum.
Yes.
Actually, Senator Hoffman, it was 1 gigabit per second.
Terabit sounds better.
Terabit does sound better.
It does sound better, Senator Hoffman. I'm guessing it costs a whole heck of a lot more. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, through the chair. I just want to lend support for the concept you brought up. It's very important. You can have the broadband, but you have to make sure that you've got the hardware, the software, the training. Everything is in place to utilize that broadband. So I'm certainly supporting that, but I do believe that you have to have an audit to ascertain what the capacity is of all these school districts and schools, because I think in some respects it may surprise you. You may have equipment that is outdated, that can't handle it. The training may not be there. So in order to maximize it, I really would suggest the committee support an audit that audits capability and capacity for all aspects of utilizing the broadband.
Senator Dunleavy, thank you for those comments. Commissioner, I've been trying to nail you down on that, so I hope that we'll look at an actual study versus a survey to understand those. We do have other issues to come before the committee. Senator Bishop?
I can switch gears now.
TVAC?
I want to talk career and tech ed for a minute.
Please.
Just a follow-up comment. You know, we're talking about broadband, and I think most of us sitting around the table when we went to school, our folks were worrying about how many pencils and Crayolas and chalk they were going to buy, and we weren't talking about broadband. But technology has changed, and I'll dovetail those comments in with, you know, Commissioner, I believe you fully support career and technical education. Is that correct?
Correct.
And I know you're familiar, if I might follow up.
Please, Senator Bishop.
Madam Chairman. I know you're familiar with this career technical education plan.
Absolutely.
And do you guys champion that still out there with the districts and try to get people implemented to fully implement this district-wide?
Yes, we do.
Because I fully believe that this is a pathway forward. I don't know what the data looks like now. I know eight years ago that when we were talking about work keys, 80% of the ACT had shown that 80% of the kids leaving high school needed to go get a career in a trade or an AA degree or less, and 20% of them need to go on to college. Is that still, I don't know if you've seen any new numbers, but...
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, the numbers are significant. So you're correct. I couldn't give you the exact percentage, but it's last I heard was in the 60s. But even so, it's a significant portion of students that take that pathway.
If you allow me one more, I'll be brief and close, ma'am.
Senator Bishop.
With that being said, here we are on the cusp of looking at another mega project. I think we all believe we're closer than we've ever been at any other point in time. And I would like to see the Department of Education and Department of Labor and the University of Alaska. I was looking for them in the room. They were here earlier, just to all continue to work together in collaboration with the 54 school districts driving this plan home. We've got the data in front of us. We know where we need to put our resources to have our workforce trained so our kids can go to work.
Mr. Hanley, any comment?
To the chair, I would wholeheartedly agree. It's one of the reasons, in a very small way, that we put forward language in this that says that for at least entities that are getting TDEF funds, that they're providing dual credits, they're giving a vision for kids in high school. Our state board is meeting more and more with the Board of Regents from the university to make sure that we've got this connection for all avenues prior to a student graduating, not just in their senior year, but helping them get that vision. So I wholeheartedly agree with your comments.
Yeah, just
Senator Bishop.
I told a fable. Just a follow-up to that. TDAP's just a small portion of the money that's going to be needed in CTE, and I've been a proponent of looking at increase in CTE dollars throughout the districts. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. We do have Juanetta Ayers on the phone. Juanetta, are you there?
Yes, Madam Chairman, I'm here.
Do you have a comment on any of Senator Bishop's dialogue with the commissioner that you'd like to add?
No, I'm available for questions, but heartily concur with the senator's comment.
Thank you. Ms. Ayers, I have a question for you. Some of the issues with workforce development is tracking what students do after they leave the system, and I'm wondering how you're collaborating with either the university system or with the Department of Education in seeing what education that we're paying for is doing for our students once they enter the workforce. Do we have data that's tracking student performance once they exit our systems?
Chairman Faircloth, thank you for that question. We do have data for portions of it, and we are working on filling gaps where there may be technical data sharing issues or legal data sharing issues. But we do have both labor and job and wage outcome data that we regularly report in the department for many of our training grant programs, both federal and state. And I will be continuing to work on filling those gaps.
Thank you, Ms. Ayers. So you're not in opposition to sharing data with K through 12 or the university system?
Thank you for that question, Chairman Faircloth. We currently do that. The Department of Labor's Research and Analysis section conducts a variety of job and wage outcome research on behalf of the university, with the university sharing their student rosters, and then our research and analysis section aggregates that. There are some technical and legal challenges with sharing with the Department of Education. We are working more specifically with our grantees in the department that receive workforce training funds, and working to overcome what some of those legal and technical issues may be.
Thank you, Ms. Ayers. Are there further questions for the commissioner? Commissioner, one of my questions has been, we talked about test out, and the other body provided for us that testing out on all subjects, and the administration had spoken about only wanting it in core subjects. Senator Dunleavy, you suggested that there might be something out there that could broaden that, and I'm wondering if we can get that on the record.
Sure, Mr. Chair. I believe there's a number of different outfits that provide tests for credit. The concept of CLEP has been around for some time, in which one can test in a variety of subjects, and if they reach a passing score, it's a fairly inexpensive test. I think it's about $87. That is then accepted as credit in, I believe it's hundreds, if not close to 1,000 universities nationwide. And the Madison School District investigated this concept several years ago when I was on the board, and we did adopt a concept similar to what is being discussed here during the session for tests for credit. And there's pre-made tests that exist that are pretty easy to administer and have been around for some time. And so I guess the point is that when we're going through this discussion, we hear that school districts would have to develop their tests and go through a lot of work. Fact is, like many of the resources we use today, they already exist and they're mass-produced. Many of them are online, easy to access. And so I would strongly urge us not to get wrapped around the axle on the thinking of we have to develop something, because there are vendors out there that have already done this. This is stuff that's been dealt with for years.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Commissioner Hanley, does the department maintain their desire to have the opt-out limited to core subjects, or given the information that was just provided, isn't there ability of local school districts at a fairly minimal amount to be able to provide students opting out of more subjects?
Yes, and as thank you. And as Senator Dunleavy mentioned, is currently available for districts. Districts can currently assess students in any way that they would like on any of their students to give them the credit, you know, once they've met mastery or proficiency. The state doesn't monitor exactly what that is, but it's done at the local level. The idea behind this is that we want to require districts, at least in those core areas, to offer those courses. And if we've got a district, unlike Mat-Su, who's been very progressive in this area and provided a lot of opportunities for students, for districts that haven't done that yet, we would like to see them do it at least in the core areas that are going to allow a student to move forward. And our sensitivity to the districts of having to develop, I don't know that there's a CLEP course for debate or for pottery or for drama. That's our sensitivity, is that we don't want to put a burden on districts that we're saying you have to make courses for these or tests for these. Instead, we want to say, look, core areas, your students should be able to opt out or test out if they have the skills necessary. And again, just to clarify, the language that is currently in there is only for courses that the school offers. So we're not asking schools to make tests for courses that they don't have.
Thank you, Commissioner. I know that that is a conversation that's been happening. And we will see what amendments come from committee members. Again, those amendments are due by 5 o'clock. Is there anything else, Senator Meyer?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, the amendments should come to my office, and probably Suzanne Armstrong, if I'm not here, or Edra Morledge is kind of collecting all of them. And thank you for making that announcement. I don't have anything else for the Commissioner, but I would like to have David Teal present.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I would tell those in the audience or those listening at home, we have about 1,000 pages of public comment right now. I'm pointing to the stack that our trusty finance aides continue to deliver to us moment by moment as they're received. But if you do have additional comments that you'd like the committee to consider, if you would send those to senate.finance.committee@akleg.gov. Again, that's senate.finance.committee@akleg.gov. We'll have those. We'll take a brief at ease.
We're going to bring the Senate Finance back to order. We're going to continue our discussion on the education bill, House Bill 278. You know, we've got a lot of different versions out there. We had the Senate education version. We had the governor's version. Actually, the one though in front of us is the House Bill version, House Bill 278. And so just to clarify, you know, we've talked about different components of the bill. David, you were here and heard that, as did the other committee members and audience and whoever may be watching. But probably the big enchilada and the thing that has most people most concerned about is the funding. And the funding itself is very confusing. It's confusing to me and I think to others. So, David, I'm going to start out the questions, and then committee members may have some additional questions. But when we talk about funding outside of the BSA, now, first of all, let me just back up. The governor had, I believe, $58 in the BSA, and then
$85.
I'm sorry? $85. Okay. That's my dyslexia coming out. $85. And then the House added 100, so it's at 185 right now. And then the House also put $30 million outside the BSA. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. So now that $30 million outside the cap, how does that get distributed to the schools? Is it distributed the same way as the BSA? Is it the unadjusted ADM, or is it adjusted ADM? That's question number one. Question number two is, if you want more local contribution, if you fund outside of the BSA, you do not get any additional local contribution. Is that correct? So those are my two questions, David.
For the record, I'm David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance Division. And I think the way I'm looking at that is, you're saying, is money inside the formula or outside the formula the same? And I'd say it depends on your perspective. From the state's perspective, you're putting a certain amount of dollars in there and it's distributed in exactly the same way. The same amount of money goes to the same school districts. So that's the answer to number one, assuming that you're distributing it according to the way you've always have in the past, which is by adjusted ADM. In other words, it's distributed exactly as if it went through the formula. From the school district's perspective, there is a difference. They would probably argue that money in the BSA is permanent and allows them to plan long term. That money outside the formula doesn't give them as much of a planning horizon because they don't know if it's going to be there. There are a couple counters to that argument, and one would be that as long as I've been here, I've never seen one-time money go away. It's in the sense that it's been removed. It has gone away in the sense that it has been incorporated into the BSA. And then you have no funding outside the formula briefly, and then it comes back a few years later. It sticks around for 3 or 4 years, and then it's rolled into the BSA. But I've never seen one-time money actually go away from the formula. Second is that the Senate sort of addressed that issue by putting outside money in for multiple years. So the school districts have a point that it's not permanent, and you know, that may affect their planning, but it really shouldn't affect their planning if they look historically. It does definitely have an impact on local contributions that are allowed. And as you said, Mr. Chairman, when money is run through the formula, then your basic need is higher. Voluntary local contributions are capped at 23% of basic need. So you can contribute more at the local level. Let's just use an example here. If you increased outside the formula funding by $100 million, Anchorage gets roughly a third, or let's just call it 30 million of that. If it were outside the BSA, then they lose the ability to contribute 23% of that $6-7 million. So if the money went through the BSA, Anchorage could contribute an extra $6-7 million to the district. That's important because they're at the cap. To some districts that are not at the cap, it would make no difference. But there are half a dozen school districts in the state whose communities fund them to the cap, so running the money outside the formula would arguably not allow them to contribute as much as they would like to.
Okay. Thank you, Dave, for explaining that. So, and then for rough numbers, for every $25 million, that equates to approximately $100 increase in the BSA. Is that
That's
safe
correct.
To say? Okay. So we're at $185 increase to the BSA, which would equate to about $45 million if I'm calculating correctly. Okay.
Correct.
So if we did, I think in the operating budget, I think the co-chairman here said that we've set aside $100 million for education. So theoretically, that equates to about a $400 BSA. If go ahead.
The only qualifier I put on that is that it really this year is $75 million because it incorporated the $25 million that we had done the year before.
Okay.
So this year would be about a $300 million increase.
$300 increase to the BSA would equate to $75 million. Okay. All right, just that's just good so we know how the math goes. Okay, so and then what you're saying is if we put that $75 million outside the cap, then we are prohibiting the local municipalities the ability to increase their contribution. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
For practical spread.
If they're at the cap. And in Anchorage's case they are, I believe Juneau is. I don't know who is and who isn't, but okay. Other questions? Did you have one there? Okay. Senator Faircliffe.
So if you were a property taxpayer in Anchorage and you put it outside of the cap, you wouldn't see a property tax increase. But if you were a taxpayer at the cap and we put it inside the formula, taxpayers would pick up the difference and have a tax increase.
You might see it. It wouldn't necessarily.
Might see, depending on what was happening.
Yeah, it would be up to the local.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Faircliffe's correct. If the city needed to raise funds to pay that extra money, then yes, you would see it has to go up. But remember, it's voluntary local contribution, so the city's under no obligation to increase. They just could increase their payments.
Okay, so David, you said if it was an adjusted ADM, it would be run the same as a BSA. Is there a non-adjusted ADM program?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I mean, the non-adjusted ADM is the headcount of students. And if you adjusted or if you distributed money according to ADM, then Anchorage would get more than its formula share. I don't want to call it fair share, but and if Anchorage gets any more, because they're already at the cap, and there's a federal disparity test saying you cannot have differences of more than 25%, REAs contribute no local contributions. The cap is 23%, and if you distributed money according to the unadjusted ADM, Anchorage would probably exceed the disparity test, as would Juneau and others who fund to the cap.
Okay, Senator Faircliffe.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, maybe we should put on the disparity test, at least, so that people understand the box that we're trapped in a bit, as a from state to municipalities that have taxing authority versus those who don't. And that's how there's interplay with the disparity test there, and I'm not sure that everyone that might be following this conversation understands the box.
I will try, Mr. Chairman, Senator Faircloth, if I don't do it right, where I have someone sitting right behind me who can straighten me out in a hurry. The federal government allows districts to get as much as 25% disparity, in other words, dollars per student differences. And in Alaska, we don't fund by head count, we fund by adjusted student count. The federal government reviews that formula and says it's okay to do it that way because the formula factors that you use to adjust for geographic issues, size factors, are all legal from our perspective on allowable factors to adjust. If you added some factors that they didn't approve of, you would break the disparity test, even though it's in the formula. So the formula right now is okay, and I think what you're referring to is the fact that REAs, because they have no local contribution required at all, they pay zero, and because we have a required local effort in urban places, that's all allowable. But now when you get to what's voluntary local effort, what's allowed outside the formula, you can only have a 25% difference between they allow like 2% bottom dropout and 2% top dropout or something like that. But basically, the lower districts can have no more than 25% less funding than the higher districts. And so you cannot distribute money outside the formula and still meet that disparity test. Again, because local contributions already make up 23% of the 25% disparity. I don't know if that explains it very well. If you have questions, Elizabeth is here and she can probably do a better job than I did.
Okay. To kind of follow up on that a little bit, I know the House wrestled with for quite a while, and somewhere along the line it got taken out, but weren't they going to mess with the school size a little bit so that the urban schools would get more, but yet you'd hold the rural schools harmless? And if you don't aren't comfortable talking about that, I know the commissioners are familiar with that.
No, I can answer that, Mr. Chairman. The House did remove the top two brackets from the size factor. That really doesn't affect the federal test because size is a valid adjustment. If you decide that your size factors have changed for some reason, then you can modify them. I think the concern that the department would have is that where was the study that supports changing that size factor? And shouldn't you take the formula seriously enough that you don't make changes via amendment or some quick process because you like what it does in terms of directing money where it needs to go at a lower cost? It should be based on the economies or diseconomies of scale that are actually experienced out there. And without knowing what those economies or diseconomies are, can you really go ahead and make changes to the formula on the fly?
Okay, and again, to help us better understand where the House got to with the bill that's before us, what are the advantages? I mean, they kind of split it. I mean, obviously, they've got $45 million towards the BSA, and they've got $30 million outside of the BSA or outside the formula. What are the advantages or disadvantages of putting money outside of the formula. We talked about having it in the formula being good because you get additional local contribution. What's the advantages of keeping it on the outside?
I think, again, the advantages of keeping it outside is that it appears to be one-time money. I guess if you were looking for solid reasons to put it outside, it may be that you're going to study the formula again. It's been since 97 that those size factors have been in place. The geographic factors were studied in 2006 or 7. All of it's due for review. And before you increase the BSA permanently, you might want to complete a study of whether those factors really are adjusting for differences the way they should be adjusting. If you make a permanent BSA increase now, arguably, if and when you complete the study and the factors change, historically speaking, nobody likes losers when you change the education formula. And if you're going to move money around because factors have changed, then you would have to increase the BSA to get rid of those districts that didn't get more money through the adjustments. If you hold the money outside the BSA, you could perhaps argue that the winners and losers argument goes away because it was one-time money while you were waiting to complete the study. And now that you're here with new numbers and a new formula, a new allocation of dollars, you can now put the money in the BSA and wouldn't have that old winners and losers argument.
Okay, and then I know there's some other questions, but just one more, and again, I don't want to hold you to this because you're the financial analysis for the legislature. But in the bill itself, I believe they do address some studies. Is one of the studies a BSA study?
Mr. Chairman, I think the only study in there is a state salary study.
Okay. Okay, very good. Senator Kelly?
David, and I'm a little rusty on formulas, but how does the federal impact aid play into the discussion about the disparity test, or does it? The REAAs they live in areas where you have federal impact aid is taking a portion of their funding?
Mr. Chairman, I could take a stab at that, but I think you're really better off getting Elizabeth up to the table for that question.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Okay, any additional questions for David before we bring up the Commissioner Elizabeth? The Senator Dunleavy.
Through the Chair, David, so from your understanding, the disparity test is how much the state contributes within that 25% tolerance. In other words, again, a district cannot have cannot exceed the 25%. Is that correct?
Through the Chair, it's not just state money. It's local money. It's any money that they receive all the money counts, and you can't go more than 25% different on a per student.
So their expenditures are not factored into this at all, is that right?
I'm not sure I understand that question.
If you have a school district where it doesn't matter where it's at, but for whatever reason, its income from the state, the PL 874, the local contribution, if it's not a municipality from the state and from the feds, but let's say they are, for whatever reason, they're not in a shortfall right now. And there are some districts in the state that are not in a shortfall right now because they've spent money in a certain manner, or they're just not necessarily expending money that other districts are. My question is, it's a funding issue as opposed to an expenditure issue.
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, it's the disparity test is based on revenue, not expenditures.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Additional questions for David? Okay. Seeing none, thank you, David. Elizabeth or Commissioner, or maybe both. There's safety in numbers, you know. Okay. If you could put your name on the record, please.
Thank you. For the record, Elizabeth Noodleman, Director of School Finance and Facilities for the Department of Education.
And Commissioner Hanley? Okay. All right. So let's see. Was it Senator Kelly? Was it your question for Elizabeth?
I'm trying to remember how federal impact aid plays into the disparity test. Does it? And if so, how? I just remember something from years ago.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Kelly. Just very briefly, Alaska has an equalized formula for distributing public education funding. Many states, if not all, have an equalized formula. And so it's set out to provide the same education across the state for different regions with different expenditures levels to acquire a teacher and the other things that support education. So Alaska has an equalized formula. Because Alaska maintains an equalized formula, within 25% from the most expensive area to the least expensive area, Alaska, through the Federal Impact Aid Program, is allowed to use Federal Impact Aid funds to fund our foundation program. So across Alaska, there's approximately $140 million in impact aid funds that are sent to our school districts. And those funds are payments in lieu of taxes for federal lands where they cannot be taxed locally. Of that $140 million that goes to our school districts, Alaska uses approximately $70 million of those dollars to fund our foundation program. Without that impact aid, without maintaining an equalized program and passing the disparity test, Alaska would not be able to use those payments in lieu of taxes to fund the foundation program. And if the program continued as it does currently, then the state would need to look for $70 million to replace that impact aid.
Senator Hoffman, refinish.
Chairman, Kelly, for the committee, can you explain where the other $70 million goes?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, there's a calculation that provides for how much school districts retain and how much the state retains. And that calculation is a ratio of local effort. And so districts that are putting in the local effort retain a portion of their impact aid. Our REAAs, the formula allows the REAAs, because they don't have a local effort, to retain 10% of the impact aid. So of the $70 million that is left in the districts, it's based on a calculation of 90% of local effort.
And for the most part, the federal lands that are a result of these revenues are primarily in rural Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I would not say they're primarily in rural Alaska, because our larger school districts have military bases, and the state receives significant impact aid funds from the military bases. So it is a breakout, and I wouldn't want to guess exactly what the breakout is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, I asked the question earlier upon local control. So we're trying to find out how much is enough money, the terms of adequate funding, flat funding, enough money, et cetera, are discussed quite frequently and yearly, actually. I've had a number of constituents contact me and ask me, as a result of the House putting in their bill studies on salary and insurance, you know, what is the Senate going to do with regard to that issue? And the question they have is, and that's why I was asking about the disparity test and the amount of money. We know that we are charged with establishing and maintaining an education, public educational system. And we know that we need to appropriate the appropriate funding. There's no doubt about it. We have to do that. The questions I'm starting to get here, especially the last couple of days, are, on the other end, in terms of expenditures, why is it that some school districts have a fund balance? Why is it that some school districts aren't calling us and saying we need more money? What is happening, if you know, what is happening in some of our school districts that is causing, quote, a shortfall? We've been told it's flat funding from the state, and yet, again, I have constituents and I have school districts in the state explain to me that they have fund balance. So if it was flat funding, why are, in your opinion, why are districts at different levels in terms of their deficits, their need to lay off teachers, their expenditures? And I know there's different geographic issues, et cetera, but our larger school districts seem to be the ones that are having difficulty right now. That was one of the reasons why the House was looking at lopping off the top two components of the school size factor to put more money into those school districts. Do you have any thoughts on the expenditure side of things?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy. Well, you mentioned fund balance, and so I would start there, and I would say that by statute, districts can only maintain 10% of their expenditures in a fund balance for an operating fund at the end of each year. And that makes sense because boilers break, roofs get leaks, teachers go out on leave, and a new teacher needs to come in to be in the classroom. So that's really the fund balance. Why districts would hold over money from one year to the next would be for unknown factors, and there is a cap on that. So far as what the needs are at each district, I wouldn't be able to step out and really speak to that for each district. I think that over the last 3 months, I've heard many, many districts with needs exactly where that stems from. One of the better discussions I've heard on it was at a Senate Education Task Force this summer, and 5 to 8 of the districts came in and gave excellent presentations, and they described what their cost drivers were and which of those were controllable and which of those were not controllable. And that information came right from the school districts, and I found it very informative.
Just a comment through the chair. I think this is one of the reasons why the certainly was one of the reasons why I introduced SB 90 was at the request of the large school districts who were having a difficult time dealing with the insurance cost issues. And I think this is why the House put their salary benefit study in to their side of the bill. I was just curious as to what your thoughts were, because it appears that our largest school districts that are municipalities that have most of the population are experiencing very similar problems with regard to deficits. And I'm not saying there are not smaller school districts or rural school districts or non-municipalities, but I do know that there are some smaller school districts, some are rural, and some are not municipalities that are not in the same boat as the rural urban school districts. So I'm just wondering if there is a funding issue or there's an expenditure issue. And I'm not, I don't know yet. We're looking into it. Just want to know what your thoughts were. Because if it's an expenditure issue, that's difficult. Well, it may be difficult to control from, I'll just leave it at that. Thanks.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I read the Anchorage paper and the Juneau paper and the Fairbanks paper, and I get the message that these schools are laying off teachers, but that doesn't mean rural schools are not facing the same problems. They might not receive the same publicity statewide as those schools, but in talking to educators and Ms. Newellman as well, they are experiencing many of the same problems in not having adequate funding. And I think that the suggestion that Mr. Teal has, instead of speculating and I don't know what was his words, making changes on the fly, aren't the way to go. I think we need to look at those studies and make those decisions as to what level of funding on all of those formulas benefit all of Alaskans as much as possible. You know, it's a shame maybe that the smaller schools in rural Alaska doesn't get the media attention, but that does not mean that they don't have the same problems.
Okay, actually, I'm going to shift gears here just a little bit, and it gets back to Senator Dunleavy's other bill, Senate Bill 100, I think it was, and that had to do with correspondence schools. And is it my understanding on the correspondence schools, how are they funded through the formula, or are they outside the formula?
For the record, Mike Hanlon, the Commissioner for the Department of Education, and they are funded at, they don't incorporate all the other components, they incorporate the BSA component. So they are funded at 0.8 of the BSA. So they don't have the geographic cost factors and all those other things. It's simply, whatever the BSA is, they're at 0.8 of that.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense because they don't have a brick and mortar to, or overhead costs that you would have with the school, correct?
I think that's the intent behind that. Correct.
Okay. Senator Dunleavy, you want to share any more on that?
I think the commissioner answered this. Why they're 0.0 or 0.80. My bill is asking it to go up to 1.0 because it's my philosophy that kids are kids, and that school districts that have correspondence programs that receive those funds, it benefits the entire school district as all these funds do. Just and briefly, for example, in the Mat-Su, you'll have some very large schools, but we also have a school that's about 20 kids. And we have some remote schools up in Glacier View and up by Talkeeton and Trapper Creek. It costs more to fund those schools just like it does out in rural Alaska. And so your homeschool correspondence kids, it's actually an inexpensive way to educate children, and the money that they bring into a district is often spread across the entire program, benefiting all the kids in that district and all the schools in it.
Yeah. Now, I know in Anchorage, I think it's called Family Partnership, but in Mat-Su, you've got a fairly large program. Is that the Mat-Su Central?
Through the chair, it's the Twinley Bridges one, and the Mat-Su Central School has about 1,700 kids. But I think the number that was arrived at years ago wasn't just an arbitrary number. Could have been 50%, could have been 95%. I think it was just some number that was plucked out of the air to attach to these kids that are part of the homeschool correspondence program.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Well, Commissioner, it's obviously it's a tough task. You know, I think I'm sure you probably assisted, if didn't write the bill for the governor on the original governor's education bill, and you know, we're dealing with so many different things, charter schools, residential schools, the high cost of funding out in rural schools, homeschool, correspondence schools, and then, you know, just the traditional schools, I guess, that I'm probably more familiar with in Anchorage that are huge. Some of them are up to 2,000 in the high schools. So, and they all have different needs and challenges. So it's a difficult issue. Okay, anything else for the Commissioner, Ms. Noodleman? Okay, with that, thank you very much. And I think that is going to conclude our discussion today. As was mentioned earlier by Senator Fairclough, if you do have some thoughts, corrections, additions to the education bill, House Bill 278, please get those to my office soon. I know a lot of you have probably been working on it for several days now. So, okay, I think Senator Kelly, what are we doing tomorrow? Yeah, let me just do a brief at ease so we understand what we're doing tomorrow. Brief at ease. I'm going to bring the Senate Finance meeting back to order here just briefly. Tomorrow's agenda is we're going to take up bills previously heard, see if we can start moving some of them out possibly. And then also, Senator Kelly, you said the purse terms will take up in the afternoon. Okay, any questions? If not, we are adjourned until tomorrow at 9:00.